I like
you
beer.
Haven't asked for that.
I like beer. I don't know if you do. Okay. Do you like beer, Senator, or not? What do you like to drink?
Next.
Oh, yeah. Brett Kavanaugh. I remember you.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica
with you.
Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR, New Orleans' WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ. In Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, in Janesville, Wisconsin on WADR, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk, amongst other fine affiliates from coast to coast, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. A quick tweet from someone who I don't even know who this person is. His name is Alex Montejano. He tweets, if selling a gay couple a wedding cake means a Christian baker participated in their marriage, does selling a gun to a murderer mean a Christian gun store owner participated in the murder?
Wow, that's quite profound.
Good question, isn't
it?
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to just leave that one, however, right there for now, though it might be worth exploring in more detail in the future. Because I need to keep things short today if I can, as we will be joined momentarily by Congressman Hank Johnson, Democrat from the Georgia's 4th Congressional District, following a letter that he, as chair of the House Judiciary Committee's subcommittee that oversees the courts, the federal courts in this country, including the U.S. Supreme Court, he and Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler sent a letter on Tuesday to the National Archives requesting a whole passel of records and documents from now Justice Brett Kavanaugh's time working in the White House counsel's office during the George W. Bush administration from 2001 to 2003, and from his time as White House staff secretary during that same administration from 2003 to 2006, documents that the Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee never bothered to even request before Kavanaugh's lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court was rammed through the U.S. Senate late last year. Now, why would Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee now be asking to see those documents at this time? Well, Congressman Johnson will be here to tell us, and I've got a number of other things I want to ask him as well, like why he is not on the list of the now majority of House Democrats who are calling for a formal impeachment inquiry on that judiciary panel of one Donald J. Trump. That is shortly he'll be with us. One other tweet I will share for now from Sarah Schaefer, who is a writer and a comedian. She tweeted yesterday, quote, I'm assuming the El Paso shooter is being held in a rancid cage where he has to sleep on the floor and drink from the toilet and not take a shower or receive medical care for weeks on end. That's what you get for breaking the law, correct? She asks. Another good tweet and another good point. We would not treat mass murderers that way. they would sue if we did and we would lose. We would not treat mass murderers the way that we are currently treating law-abiding migrants who did nothing more than cross the border and legally turn themselves in to seek asylum. All of, that's perfectly illegal. That's perfectly legal. Anyway, two good points from the Twitter sphere. So remember those soft-spoken, gentle, conciliatory words that Donald Trump read off the teleprompter at the White House on Monday after the weekend of mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, which resulted in the deaths of 31 and dozens more critically injured? You'll recall that he claimed to be decrying white nationalism and racism without taking any personal responsibility for helping to fuel that fire, while claiming to be reaching out to Democrats for bipartisan solutions to our nation's epidemic of gun violence, even though he offered no specific measures for actually doing so. Still, speaking Monday from the teleprompter in the White House, Trump said this.
Now is the time to set destructive partisanship aside, so destructive, and find the courage to answer hatred with unity, devotion, and love.
Set destructive partisanship aside, find courage to answer with unity, devotion, and love. Well, you will be shocked to learn that that did not last long. Hours after President Trump headed to Dayton and El Paso on Wednesday on a mission to, quote, help heal, after a mass shooting apparently motivated in El Paso by anti-immigrant hatred, he lashed out at former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic presidential candidate and native son of El Paso, for supposedly changing his name to appeal to Hispanic voters. Trump tweeted just before midnight on Tuesday, so he barely lasted 24 hours in his promise to set destructive partisanship aside, Desi Doyen. Did you think? Shouldn't he get credit for lasting that long?
No, absolutely not. That's like a sub-ground level of below the bar.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where the bar is. Anyway, he tweeted, Beto, phony name to indicate Hispanic heritage, O'Rourke, who is embarrassed by my last visit to the great state of Texas, where I trounced him and is now even more embarrassed by polling at 1% in the Democrat primary, should respect the victims and law enforcement and be quiet. That's what Trump tweeted just before midnight on Tuesday. The attack raised the discredited claim that O'Rourke had adopted a Spanish language nickname as a political tactic, but it struck a jarring tone barely 24 hours after Trump had called for bipartisan cooperation in the wake of the two mass shootings over the weekend that claimed at least 31 lives, according to Washington Post. O'Rourke, who was raised in El Paso and represented the area in Congress for 6 years, has relentlessly criticized the president in the wake of the shooting. O'Rourke suggested that Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric helped inspire the shooter, who police believe left a manifesto that raged against a Hispanic invasion of Texas. Trump has derisively used the word invasion repeatedly to describe migrants coming to this country, largely from Central America to the U.S. to claim asylum.
This is an invasion. I was badly criticized for using the word invasion. It's an invasion. People hate the word invasion, but that's what it is. It's an invasion.
I call it invasion. They always get upset when I say an invasion, but it really is somewhat of an invasion.
Because I consider it an invasion.
That's an invasion. That's an invasion.
Some people call it an invasion. It's like an invasion. But this is an invasion, and nobody's even questioning that.
So, yeah, he's kind of used that word before. Just the same word that the shooter in El Paso reportedly used. Now, O'Rourke had said at a vigil on Sunday that, quote, we have a president right now who traffics in this hatred, who incites this violence, who calls Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals, calls asylum seekers animals and an infestation, all of which, by the way, is 100% true. That was on Sunday before Donald Trump's call for unity on Monday, before he then lashed out at O'Rourke on Tuesday. In hitting back at O'Rourke, Trump resurrected that old claim that he had shunned his given name of Robert for Beto, a common Hispanic nickname, as a cynical ploy for votes. You'll recall that Senator Ted Cruz, whose actual name, by the way, as the son of Cuban immigrants, is actually Rafael, but he goes by Ted. He made a similar claim in ads released just after O'Rourke won the primary in Texas to challenge him last year for the U.S. Senate. Anyway, the claim was raised again on Tuesday night by a guest on Fox News' Tucker Carlson's show, where O'Rourke was compared to Rachel Dolezal. Remember her, the white woman?
Really?
Yes.
They think that's the same idea.
Yeah, same
wow.
thing. A white woman and a former NAACP official who posed as a black woman. So anyway, you know, O'Rourke told the Washington Post that he was actually given the nickname growing up in El Paso. He even provided a childhood photo, and it's a darling photo, by the way, where he wore a shirt with a nickname on it, Beto, right across the front. He couldn't have been more than 3 years old in this picture.
Well, obviously, Beto's parents and yeah. he himself as a three-year-old yes. decided that way in advance of his presidential
oh, yes.
run and his Senate run that he needed to fake this.
Yes. Oh, it's devious. Clearly, unchecked ambition, even as a two-year-old, planning to win votes with a Hispanic-ish sounding name. Anyway, he was also using the nickname in newspaper stories as early as 2002, which is a decade before he ever ran for Congress, according to the Post, responding to Trump's tweet early on Wednesday morning, in which Trump had told him to keep quiet. O'Rourke ignored the dig at his name and instead promised to continue criticizing the president. He retweeted Trump's tweet and added, 22 people in my hometown are dead after an act of terror inspired by your racism. El Paso will not be quiet, and neither will I. Well, we will see how quiet El Paso will remain. Even as we go to air, Donald Trump is in El Paso. He arrived late on Wednesday afternoon after remaining largely out of public view when he visited Dayton, Ohio, on a day of visits intended to console cities recovering from the pair of mass shootings over the weekend. As he left the White House on Wednesday morning, Trump suggested he would refrain from attacking his political adversaries during the trip. He said, I would like to stay out of the political fray. That, of course, was just hours after he had attacked Beto O'Rourke. And, of course, that detente lasted mere hours. By the time Trump had left Dayton and boarded Air Force One for El Paso, he had not even gotten to El Paso yet. He was back on Twitter and attacking Democrats. He lashed out at Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown and Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, who he had met and spoke with both of them in Dayton. He falsely accused them of mischaracterizing the reception that he received during about 2 hours of meetings at Miami Valley Hospital with first responders, hospital staff, and survivors of the shooting in Dayton early Sunday morning, which left 9 dead. Trump tweeted, it was a warm and wonderful visit, tremendous enthusiasm and even love. Then I saw failed presidential candidate Sherrod Brown and Mayor Whaley totally misrepresenting what took place inside the hospital. Their news conference after I left for El Paso was a fraud. I suspect he did not see the news conference. Neither Brown nor Whaley said Trump received a poor reception at the hospital. Speaking to reporters after Trump's visit to Dayton, Brown said that Trump was comforting in his talks with patients at the hospital. Whaley, Mayor Whaley, was even more confused. She said, I'm really confused, as she read Trump's tweets about her and Brown, according to a video that was posted by the Cincinnati Inquirer. We said he was treated like very well, so I don't know why they're talking about misrepresenting. Anyway, aside from brief appearances on the airport tarmac as he arrived and departed, Trump did not speak publicly or allow himself to be photographed. Reporters traveling with him were secluded as he took part in what aides described as meetings at Miami Valley Hospital with first responders, hospital staff, and survivors of the shooting. The visit was a marked break with tradition, the Washington Post notes, as presidents visiting grieving communities typically offer public condolences and use the opportunity to try to comfort the nation. Both Brown and the Dayton mayor said that they used their time with Trump to lobby him to push for an assault weapons ban and stronger background checks, among other measures. Nonetheless, White House social media Dan Scavino lashed out at the two Democrats, accused them of, quote, lying and completely mischaracterizing what took place with the president's visit to the hospital today. So everyone's just sort of baffled by that. This Trump White House, they just keep setting their destructive partisanship aside, don't they? And they're finding the courage to answer hatred with unity, devotion, and love. Scavino said the president was treated like a rock star inside the hospital, which was all caught on video. They all loved seeing their great president. Jesus. Anyway,
which is not true, because it wasn't all caught on video. He wasn't allowing himself to be photographed.
There was probably private video that they're just not sharing with anybody.
Well, I will say that New York Times columnist Charles Blow did tweet out a video and say, oh my God, you are not already cutting a campaign ad out of this visit to Dayton,
Ohio.
Oh
yeah, of course they are.
I know.
Of course. Anyway, soon after that, he flew to El Paso, but before he even got there, he criticized Democrats on Twitter, including Joe Biden, said he watched some footage of Joe Biden delivering remarks today in Iowa, said the speech was so boring. The lamestream media will die in the ratings and clicks with this guy. It'll be over for them, not to mention for the country. It'll be one big crash, but at least China will be happy. So this is how he is, you know, putting destructive partisanship aside. Biden's response to Trump in return was that he should get a life. Trump was greeted by scores of protesters in downtown Dayton. He was also expected to encounter more in El Paso, where 22 people died Saturday in that massacre that appeared to target immigrants. Back in Dayton, by the way, there was a caravan of emergency vehicles that were parked in such a way to separate protesters from the back entrance where the president's motorcade pulled in and, of course, shielded him from protesters and from the public there. But speaking to reporters before he left Washington this morning, he dismissed critics who have suggested that his rhetoric on race and immigration is partly to blame for a rise in hate-inspired violence such as that in El Paso. He said, quote, I think my rhetoric brings people together.
Wow.
He said that he is concerned about the rise of any group of hate, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's any other kind of supremacy. So, you know, white supremacy and all of the other types of supremacy, they're all bad, yet they all have fine people. He called his critics people who are looking for political gain. Not him, though. Meanwhile, in El Paso, some residents of the city were distressed by his visit. Albert Hernandez, 55-year-old man who used to support Trump, said that changed over the weekend when his sister and his brother-in-law were gunned down by the El Paso shooter. He said in recent years that his sister and her husband shared concerns that Trump was stoking racist and xenophobic sentiment with his rhetoric. Until this point, other relatives, including him, would often disagree. He said, I was the one who would tell them they were exaggerating. But now, with this tragedy, it is the total opposite. Now that it has hit this family, people are starting to wake up.
Funny how that happens. Trump, he said, does not seem to understand that he needs to stop because he's awakening these killers. He doesn't seem to understand that these people, these assassins, feel like they are his soldiers. Trump met with some family members of the shooting victims, apparently, when he visited El Paso on Wednesday. Hernandez, however, said no one from his family received an invitation from the president's office. Even if they had, he added, he likely would have not attended. Honestly, he said, as a proud American, a patriotic American, I think Trump should stay away from El Paso. He is making it worse. So that's where we are today. And by the way, after his scripted calls for unity on Monday, Trump also managed to tie the shooter in Dayton to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in another tweet early this morning. But hey, let's talk to someone who isn't insane, shall we? About our stolen U.S. Supreme Court and what, if anything, Democrats in Congress might plan on doing about it. Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia is standing by to join us next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. Yeah, me too. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Democrats in the U.S. House are trying to get some truth. We'll see if they are successful. Top Democrats on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee on Tuesday sent a letter to the National Archives and Records Administration requesting the production of documents from Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's tenure as a White House lawyer and from during his 3 years of service as White House Staff Secretary, both during the George W. Bush administration. The letter, signed by House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler and Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia, who chairs the Judiciary Subcommittee overseeing the federal courts, points specifically to materials that were either withheld from or not requested by the Republican-led U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee during Kavanaugh's contentious confirmation fight last year. And yes, that was just late last year. I know it seems an eternity ago. But under the Presidential Records Act, congressional committees of jurisdiction can access records that contain information that is needed for the conduct of their business and that is not otherwise available, according to the statute. Citing that statute to the National Archives, the Democrats explain the requested documents are relevant to ethics and transparency legislation that Congress is considering now for the federal judiciary. And they cite essentially three groups of documents from Kavanaugh's service during the Bush administration as both White House counsel and then as staff secretary. During Kavanaugh's confirmation proceedings last year, the Senate Judiciary Chair Chuck Grassley had requested only documents from Kavanaugh's service in the White House counsel's office from 2001 to 2003. And of those records turned over to Grassley, thousands of documents had reportedly been withheld after a review by Kavanaugh's own personal attorney. As a result of this process, the Democrats write in their letter, the Senate Judiciary Committee received only a small fraction of Justice Kavanaugh's White House records before voting on his nomination. They are now seeking both the documents that were turned over to the Grassley Committee and those that were not from Kavanaugh's time in the White House counsel's office. Moreover, they also request all records that pertain to Kavanaugh's tenure as White House staff secretary from 2003 to 2006, which Grassley never even sought. That including, quote, emails sent to or received by Justice Kavanaugh, including emails on which he was a carbon or blind copy recipient, including documents attached to such emails, and the textual records contained in Justice Kavanaugh's office files from the period during which he served as staff secretary. that, again, was from 2003 to 2006. A whole lot of stuff went on during that period. None of those records have ever seen the light of day in public or in Congress, much less prior to last year's wildly contentious vote on Kavanaugh's lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. So why would Democrats in the House now seek those records? And what are the chances that they will actually be turned over on a voluntary basis by the National Archive? Well, here with hopefully some answers to those questions and a few other related ones that I hope to ask is one of the two signatories on that letter. Congressman Hank Johnson represents the great state of Georgia's 4th Congressional District and serves on the House Judiciary Committee, where he also serves as chair of the Subcommittee on Courts, Intellectual Property, and the Internet. Congressman, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you for having me, Brad, and thanks for the great work that you do illuminating the public on these issues of government that they need to know about that are so relevant to our lives.
You're very kind to say so, sir, but I'm not going to be any nicer in my questioning just because of that. As noted, I've got several things to ask, but as it's been a while since you've been on the show, I guess it's, you know, been a slow news year or so. Let's start with this document.
Well, maybe I'm in your doghouse for some reason.
No,
I don't know.
No, not yet, but we'll see how things go. Let's start with this document request. You note in the letter that the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction encompasses the laws governing judicial ethics and the judicial oath of office, judicial disqualification and misconduct, and the organization of the Supreme Court, and that your subcommittee is considering legislative proposals to create a code of conduct for Supreme Court justices and is reviewing proposals regarding transparency in the court's proceedings, the adequacy of justices' financial disclosures, and the circumstances in which justices or judges must disqualify themselves from cases. In fact, while there is a code of conduct explaining circumstances requiring recusal, etc., for all judges in the federal court system across the country, those rules specifically do not apply to the U.S. Supreme Court or its justices. Recusals there are completely optional and left up to each justice to decide on their own. Am I correct on that, sir?
Yeah, that is correct. The judicial rules of ethics only apply to judges below the U.S. Supreme Court. Those are courts that are set up. They are authorized under Article 3,
mm-hmm.
But Congress has set these courts up. The U.S. Supreme Court is the only court that is recognized by the Constitution under Article 3. And so, therefore, the thinking has been that that is a court that is not as subject to legislative or Article 1 authority as mm-hmm. the other courts that the Article 1 legislative branch set up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a theory that remains to be tested. And but the bottom line is the U.S. Supreme Court has not seen fit to apply a code of ethics to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the legislation which I have introduced, which is the Supreme Court Ethics Act,
mm-hmm.
would require the Judicial Conference, which is a group of judges mm-hmm. set up by the U.S. Supreme Court that governs the operations of the courts.
Mm-hmm.
It would require that judicial conference to promulgate a code of ethics for the U.S. Supreme Court to apply to itself. And then we would, at that point, have a code of ethics that applies to the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court.
But as you said, that would be something that would then need to be tested, whether it was a violation of the separation of powers, whether the Congress could actually pass a law that puts essentially a mandate on the Supreme Court, right?
That's correct. And but meanwhile, because of the pressure that that it feels, the U.S. Supreme Court is in the process of now promulgating its own code of ethics for itself. And that remains to have been released to the public. I'm not sure that the justices have completed their work on their own code of ethics, but certainly it would be good for them to apply a code of ethics to themselves, and that would negate the need for there to be any kind of legislative fix in that regard. So I want to respect the autonomy of the third co-equal branch of government, but yet and still there are they have to be accountable. They are not unaccountable, and they certainly can be subject to the edicts of the legislative branch, but the legislative branch wants to be very respectful of the autonomy of the need for autonomy of the judicial branch. And so I look forward to the judicial branch, the U.S. Supreme Court, applying a code of ethics to itself.
So how does this document request now for Justice Kavanaugh apply here? What are you hoping to discover in these documents from his time both as in the White House counsel's office and those documents from his time as White House staff secretary that nobody has seen? What are you hoping to discover in those records?
Well, I hope to discover that Justice Kavanaugh has been completely forthright and honest with the U.S. Senate during its confirmation process. Moreover, I hope to find that the conduct of Justice Kavanaugh during his time as secretary with the Office of Counsel for the President at all times conducted himself in a way that would be in keeping with that of someone who now serves on the U.S. Supreme Court with a lifetime tenure. And, of course, that is only subject to the House's ability to impeach, should there be a need for it. And so the American people need to know the conduct of Justice Kavanaugh while he was working for the Bush administration at a time when, we were running up to the war in Iraq. We were dealing with torturing people who were captured on the battlefield. What role did Justice Kavanaugh play in the many decisions that Bush administration took during that time? It was a political position as well as a policy position. And the American people deserve to know who we have on the U.S. Supreme Court, what his background is, and if he was honest with the Senate in his confirmation proceedings.
Now, presuming that you do get those materials, and let's say you do find something that contradicts what he told the Senate, something troubling or even disqualifying from his record, your committee does have the jurisdiction to begin impeachment proceedings of both federal judges and Supreme Court justices. Am I correct there?
That is correct.
And so these materials could be considered for something like that. If they are turned over, would they be these records? Are these records that Congress would be able to share with the public, in fact?
Yes, they would. I mean, it makes no it makes no difference to the public for there to be secret documents that they are not privy to. And so my aim would be for his records to be known by the public, as they should have been during the confirmation process for the U.S. Senate, which they, under the leadership of the Republicans who controlled the Judiciary Committee at the time, they weren't interested in anything other than a speedy confirmation. They weren't interested in whether the background of Justice Kavanaugh lent itself to him being confirmed or not.
And as I noted,
they just simply wanted to confirm him.
Yeah, as I noted in the intro, there were thousands of documents that were actually reviewed before they were turned over to Chuck Grassley in the Senate that were actually reviewed by Kavanaugh's personal attorney and withheld. Some 2,000 documents, as I understand it, were not given over to the committee. Will Justice Kavanaugh's personal attorney have once again the say so over which documents actually get turned over to you guys?
No, because our request is to the National Archives.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that documents were withheld on the basis of a private lawyer handpicked for the job deciding what the Senate would see or not. And so we won't have that same burden in terms of receiving the documents. Our burden this time will be the Trump administration's edict to obstruct all congressional oversight and cooperation with Congress in its oversight responsibility. That, I believe, will be our burden, but we do not know since our letter just went out yesterday.
And that letter was a request for documents from the National Archives. It sounds like you do expect that the Trump administration may continue their extraordinary measures to block any and all such document production. If so, do you and your co-signatory there, Chairman Nadler, intend to subpoena if necessary, to go to court if necessary, to get at these documents?
Yeah, I believe that would be our next course of action should we not be able to receive these documents voluntarily.
I very much look forward to what we learn from this and what, if anything, happens. Do you have any sense whatsoever? I realize you may just be guessing at this point, but do you have any sense whatsoever of the timeline that we're looking at? I don't think in your letter that you included a deadline for turning these documents over from the National Archive. Is this something we can look forward to in the next couple of months, or are we going to be looking at these over the next several years at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, we have to always be in the posture of reasonably accommodating or accepting any reasonable accommodations that the National Archives may need in its production of the documents. And so we await their response to the letter, and we stand ready to allow for reasonable accommodations. Perhaps they are still looking for and compiling the data which we have asked for. And if that is their response, we will abide by that and look forward to them completing that task. If they have all of the documents in hand at this time, then I would expect that they would turn them over or assert some type of privilege, which would be a rationale or a basis for them not turning it over, and we'll deal with that once we get there.
Well, Congressman Johnson, I am very happy that you have not forgotten about this matter. It seems like so long ago, even though it was just late last year, that this confirmation process happened. So I'm glad you are still on it. I've got, as I mentioned, a couple of other sort of related questions here. As chair of the House subcommittee that oversees our nation's courts, do you feel like I do, and like I know many other Americans do, that our U.S. Supreme Court has been stolen, that the Republican majority is stolen and, frankly, illegitimate as I see it? And if so, do you feel like I do that when and if Democrats can win back the Senate and the White House and hopefully retain their House majority, that that you all should exercise the statutory right to expand the U.S. Supreme Court, to unpack it, if you will, by law, in order to restore what rightfully should have been a Democratic majority?
Well, I believe that it's no question that the courts have been stacked with judges with a particular political bent of mind, and they have been pre-cleared and selected by the very political organization, the Federalist Society, which is founded and headed by a well-known political operative by the name of Leo, I believe is his name. And so he has been very effective in enabling the installation of judges who have come through his fraternity, his secret society.
Right.
Everyone is not a member or allowed to become members of it, only select individuals. And they are steeped in a economic philosophy that is in keeping with Republican economic philosophy. Corporate personhood is something that they hold quite dear. And also laissez-faire capitalism is what their philosophy upholds. And their rulings are in keeping with those philosophies.
Right.
And they have stacked the courts with those types of judges.
Mm-hmm.
They've stacked the U.S. Supreme Court with two appointed by President Trump. And so he's paying back the debt that he owes for his election. And if he should get any more selections on the U.S. Supreme Court, I expect that those will be in keeping with his last two. And that means that the legislative branch has to look at the operations of the court to see whether or not the courts continue to operate in the way that the framers intended. And they intended not a false, fake, originalist thinking, textualist, abiding by U.S. Supreme Court. They look at, I believe, they meant for the Constitution to be a living document, one that is construed in accordance with the times. And so when we have a backward-looking U.S. Supreme Court that is trying to determine the original intent of the framers, who had no way of knowing what the future would hold, they're holding the future back, and it's hurting America. And so we, as the legislative branch, with the power to expand the Supreme Court, I mean, nothing in the Constitution says that it will be a court of nine justices. So we have to look at whether or not it's in the efficiency of our process that we need to expand the court.
So
there's nothing in the Constitution that says each and every justice should be on the panel that decides each and every case that comes before the U.S. Supreme Court. So there could be a scenario where there would be a larger group of justices, and a number of them would be selected to handle or decide a particular case that would come in front of them. So there are a number of different proposals that could make the operations of the Supreme Court better. They only accept a small percentage of the cases that come before them. Perhaps they should be staffed with justices such that they could consider more cases. So we need to consider all of these possibilities. We need to hear from experts in academia as well as in the practice of law about the operations of the court and whether or not it could be better.
Well, put me down, Congressman, for a vote in favor of expanding the court, if only to respond to what the Republicans did to it, to the U.S. Supreme Court in particular, but yes, the lower courts as well. I'm glad to hear that you are open to that expansion. Just one reason why Democrats need to get back the majority in the Senate and win back the White House next year, in my opinion. I've got just go ahead.
And one thing, Brad, we really don't need to politicize the courts.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the courts have been politicized.
Yep.
And so the question is, what do we do? And how will the Supreme Court react to the fact that the legislative branch is open to looking at alternatives to the current way that it does business? Just because the Supreme Court justices have ruled predictably against civil rights, voting rights, prison reform, corporate personhood,
mm-hmm.
Consumer protection. Just because they have ruled predictably in those areas in the past does not mean that they will not, as Justice Souter
mm-hmm.
kind of had a metamorphosis of thinking and made start doing a little better by way of the American people, in my humble opinion, as opposed to being so wedded to corporate interests. So, you know, I remain with an open mind about how the court will proceed as we move into the future, as it considers these important cases that are coming up before it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll just have to see.
About 2 weeks ago in the Judiciary Committee, Congressman, you questioned Robert Mueller yourself on several clear instances of obstruction of justice by Donald Trump when he was when he asked his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to have the special counsel fired and then to lie about having done so and falsify records and so forth in the bargain. Congressman, there is now a majority of members in the Democratic caucus in the House who have publicly called for an official impeachment inquiry to be opened in your Judiciary Committee, including a majority on the panel, on the Judiciary panel on which you sit. Now, CNN has a list of all the Democrats who have gone on record to call for an impeachment investigation. I think it's 118 now to date. But, Congressman, there must be a mistake on their list because I don't see your name on it for some reason, so I'm wondering, how do you explain what must clearly be an error on CNN's part? And in fact, would you like to now do the right thing by correcting the record here on the broadcast, sir?
Well, I knew somehow that I had made it to one of your lists, and that's probably the reason why. That CNN list is correct, and I'm not on it. I believe that we are proceeding in the nature of an impeachment inquiry
mm-hmm.
At this time, and we're doing so without calling it an impeachment inquiry so as not to put the 31 red to blue winners in 2018,
mm-hmm.
New Democrats, not to put them in jeopardy of not being able to come back and keep us in the majority in 2020. I think we should note that at this point, polls show that a majority of the American people are not in favor of impeachment. And certainly in some of those races where I think 16 of them were decided by less than a 3% margin of error,
mm-hmm.
I think that many of those districts still do not support impeachment, and so I don't want to endanger our majority
mm-hmm.
in 2020. So I think we should proceed as we're doing. We're in the nature of a impeachment inquiry with our oversight responsibilities, and I think we need to continue to press the action as we've been doing. And at some point, we may accumulate the record that we can then pass impeachment resolutions on and then proceed to the Senate with the evidence, not just the Mueller report, but have the evidence, the testimony, mm-hmm. the exhibits that support the testimony, take that over to the U.S. Senate and have a trial.
And I will just note, Congressman, that when Richard Nixon was reelected in a landslide, and then impeachment proceedings began, he had 70% approval rating at the beginning of the impeachment proceedings, and then 30% at the end when he was forced to quit. So I do hear what you're saying. I'm just not sure the thinking that an impeachment would actually help somehow Donald Trump. But you know more about these things than I do.
It would certainly give him an opportunity to claim that he is being mistreated by the House of Representatives.
He does that every day.
And then once he is found not guilty by the Senate, then he can also claim that, hey, the Senate has found that I am not guilty.
Yeah.
And that would come right around the time of his election.
Yeah.
And so I think all in all, with the American people not being with impeachment at this time, I think there's no need for us to jeopardize our majority by saying that we are going to impeach the president right now. We just need to continue to gather the evidence. And as we do that, the American people's minds will change, just as they did with Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm. I hope you're right. Congressman, before you go, Georgia, we've been covering a lot on this show. Georgia is moving from a 100% unverifiable touchscreen system to an all-new 100% unverifiable touchscreen system before the computer ballot marking device before the 2020 presidential election in Georgia, which could finally flip blue next year. Do you have the same concerns about this new system coming into Georgia as of now that I do, rather than a system of hand-counted paper ballots there? I'm sorry, hand-marked paper ballots.
Yeah, I think the way to go is to have the paper-marked, hand-marked paper ballots that are then scanned into a counting machine and counted, and then you have the paper ballots that you can test the results of the counting machine tally against, and that way you can have a verifiable vote. You can have an accurate vote. You can have a vote that you can have a meaningful recount. But we cannot do it on this new system that the Georgia legislature has authorized. And I think it's $125 or $150 million expenditure that will be for a system that we can't even rely on. And I think it's bad for the taxpayers, it's bad for the voters, it's bad for democracy, and it's a bad move for Georgia.
I'm with you on that. I'll keep working with you on the impeachment matter, but I think we're right on target on Georgia's voting systems. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, I tell you what, if you call me back in about 2 or 3 months, maybe I will have changed on impeachment.
Well, I may take you up on that, sir. Congressman Hank Johnson from Georgia's 4th Congressional District. You can, of course, find out more on him at hankjohnson.house.gov. And you can find him on the Twitters at Rep. Hank Johnson. He's a member of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee and the chair of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Courts, Intellectual Property, and Internet. Thank you, Congressman. It's always a delight to speak with you, my friend.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it.
My pleasure. Okay, I did it again, didn't I, Des?
Yes.
Okay.
We're out of time.
We are. A quick break. We're back with our closing few minutes right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. In all fairness, it's not really my fault that we ran so late, is it?
No. I have to say, Representative Johnson has a lot of really interesting stuff to say.
He's got a lot to say. He's kind of a slow talker.
Well, and, he is from the South.
And I had a lot of questions to ask. So it's everyone's fault. I'm sorry about that. What did you think, by the way, of his thoughts on why he's not on the impeachment, why he's not on board on the impeachment inquiry?
Well, I believe that he made a good case for it. And I understand the thinking behind that right now the Democrats seem to feel that it's going to endanger their House majority. And that right now is kind of super critical to hang on to. But, you know, the more that they talk about it, hopefully, the more the public will change in its polling.
He called this what they're doing now is in the nature of an impeachment inquiry.
Yeah.
And I guess there's a very real concern that it will somehow put the House in danger. I don't think that it will, in danger of, you know, going somehow to Republicans. I don't think it will. I think they're totally wrong. But I think they have a legitimate case that they believe in, correctly or incorrectly. I was also, by the way, very happy to hear, and we got to talk with him a little bit more during the break, that he is very well read up on what is going on in the fight over those 100% unverifiable voting machines that are coming into Georgia.
Yes, good to know.
So I'm glad he's paying attention to that closely as well. And I am particularly happy that he has not forgotten about Brett Kavanaugh.
No.
It'll be interesting to see what comes back in those documents if they ever are able to get them. And I was also happy to hear that he sounded quite took him a while to answer it, but he was quite open, it sounded like, to the idea, at least, of expanding the Supreme Court.
Very interesting times.
Interesting times. May you live in interesting times, says the old Chinese curse. I think we are cursed. All right, that's it. Got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Of course, to Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia's 4th Congressional District, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We will be back again tomorrow. Until then, if you missed any portion of today's show or any other, I hope you will feel free to download it from bradblog.com for free, which is thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to support our work here with either a one-time donation or, even better, an automated sustaining monthly pledge for our work. You know, you listen to us every day. Why not pitch in a little something into the tip jar? We could really use it. You can drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.